Session number 9926, Reel 5.
Did you ever get any parcels from home?
Yes. And my parents used to send me postal orders, and you change them with the clerk or the the unit. And when I change them, you could buy something then when you're out of the train, when you're near a little place where you could. I used to give I wanted to change this, and then the clerk, there'd be a clerk outside, he wasn't in the trench at all, but behind, and he'd say, well, being that your parents are good enough to put your name on it and address or something, show me your pay book, will you? And I was showing him the, and then he'd change, and in case somebody had picked it up. And when I got a chance, we wouldn't have a chance for a spell of us to get something out of it. You'd call in one of the farms. The farms out there were much smaller in size than what they are here. A farm there, say 10 acres, it's a good farm. And they're growing a bit of everything you think about. Beans, small beans, and peas, small these and that. And that's their farming. Of course, there are large farms there, but generally they're like the Belgians and the Dutch, I mean. Small units they got, but it's like a park, of course. Every inch has been taken advantage of.
How did you get on with them, the French and the Belgians?
Well, the French and the Belgians. One book, when we were out there, we hadn't been out there long. And we are a bit down back, you see. That's what we call out to rest. We are going out for rest. The rest, you're coming out. Somebody's going into your sector, right? And say, the sector is so much. And then you're going back here doing a bit of gymnasium to start with. And If you could find a pair of boxing gloves, it'd be all right. You see, a bit of fun. If you could, but you couldn't find them. We did have them some out there, once or twice, you know. But you're going back straight away in some other part of the line, you know.
How about yours? You sang me that lovely song earlier that you sang on the boat about your homeland.
Oh.
Did you have other songs that you used to sing that you could sing me
when
you were in rest?
No, there's not much singing about that. No. Only Tipperary. Tipperary at the beginning, you see. Well, of course, it's all. I'm telling you, I hadn't learned anything about, knew nothing about this song until we all started up. And so lovely voices there.
Yes,
singing. Youngsters, young voices and good. voices.
Yes, one hears about the Welsh singing hymns at the front they went to battle.
Oh yes. They would sing.
Did that happen at Mamet's Wood?
At times, you wouldn't have much chance because in the beginning, every house in the country there was selling beer, at least beer and wines. And the one kind of beer they bock, B-O-C-K, they used to, that's what we got here, bock. But they're not so strong as our wine, as our beer. And then it came, in the end, with all this moving about back and forth, well, you couldn't have the same chance to have a drink as because they wouldn't be so close to the battling, to the firing line.
You were telling me about the parcels your family
sent. Oh yes,
to.
And the parcels again.
Yes.
I had a bottle of whiskey out. They were sending me something out all the time. I had a bottle of whiskey, Irish whiskey this one, and I had it safely.
And how about letters? Were you able to write to your parents and get letters back regularly?
But they were all censored. Only in you could send a confidential letter, one a month. One confidential letter, business-like or any secrecy, any whatever. They wouldn't censor them. But the officer in charge of your unit, whoever was in charge there, he'd censor them and write on your writing paper. I remember now that the boys were carrying stripes here. I was seeing bloke Cockney boy with Smithy and Smithy, Liza and Smithy. And you got two stripes and a corporal. Will, Taff, Will. Yes, write me another Will. Oh, dear. And write him one another. Full of condolence and sympathy and things like that. But he needed one, of course. And he, there's a boy there, on the Somme again. But the Somme was long, you see, and like the Amman Valley, all the way down to Ammerford, and from there to the sea, and then Swansea Valley again, from there, behind that mountain there, down all the way to the docks. And the same out there, you see, the Somme Valley meant a good length then, on either side.
You were going to tell me a story, weren't you?
Eh?
You were going to tell me a story about someone on the Somme.
Oh yes. An Irish boy he was. He was partially covered here. Dead. And only just hadn't been there long, is he? And what shall we do? We took his credentials now then, his number and things like that, you see. And write me a letter, he said, write me a letter. To the parents, though, I wrote a nice letter, condolence and sympathy, and told you will understand that we can't explain to you, we can't tell you from what part we are writing now, where we can't tell you what part of the country we are writing from, but this and that, we'll wrote what we thought and how we felt about it. And we sent some of his correspondence, some of his business, something in the bodyguard. And we had a nice parcel back from Ireland, cake and things like this. And an invitation after the war, if possible. I mean, an invitation for him, for us. For him, because I was writing in his name, he wanted me to write in his name. And
did you find it upsetting when people you were fond of died, you know, were killed at the front? Was it an upsetting experience for you?
Oh, yes. When you heard about them, especially people you knew, friends, and
Something else I was going to ask you. Did you suffer much from lice at the front?
Terrible. My sister would be stopping with us now. And she was saying, she was younger than me, 7 years. And when I came back on leave, the first thing she and my mother used to do was to burn my underclothing all off, because we were taking advantage of every pan of water we could find anywhere to wash our clothes, especially during the dry weather, and put it down if it was in summer and a bit of sun about, but about to dry. And then, after doing the best to scrub the underwear, vests and things like that, singlets, you'd put them out to dry, and then you'd find what you'd been scribbling and thought you had killed, the seams inside. See, I'm walking again. Lice, big bugger. And the first thing they used to do when I used to come home was to burn the woolly shoe and give you fresh stuff to go back in, underwear, I mean. And what did you say? Oh, yes. Once on the Somme there, when Douglas Haig, I remember him in a car there, and I'm not certain whether King George was with him, but he was somewhere about there. He did visit those parts during the war, see? And I saw him.
What does he look like?
I saw Haig.
Yes.
I saw him.
What does he look like?
Exactly the same as when you'd find him in, what do you call it, in his...
What did you all think?
And we, our commander then, battery commander, was Bryn Lewis. His name is on the cenotaph in Punta de Oye. They don't put ranks there, only the name. For everybody the same, see? If you're a corporal or a colonel, there's nothing like that to count. And he was giving orders. He was listening now to the phone by our battery on the Somme there, the part we were then. And he was having those the orders he was given. So he said, I guess, this bloke would come to join us, now, see, coming up to the replacement from somewhere. He was bragging, you know, he was from some the Midlands, the Midland Counties or something. And you're supposed to be in charge of the racing stable, some lord or duke or something, And he thought he knew a lot. And he was blaming now, see, the orders are coming back from the front line. And the complaints, you see, about the shooting. And this bloke, so the major went down, and he was blaming blaming everybody but himself, and he went down and listened to him. It was this bugger, he didn't know what he was talking about. It was he was doing the blame. He was doing the wrong, you see. Oh, he called him everything unthreatened.
Another one again.
Something was wrong coming through from the front to the battery. And as we are talking here now, and something interfering, you see? Something interfering all the time. It was only just a plain wire from here to the trenches. And so what we did then, you see, we switched to Welsh. We're talking Welsh. The bloke in front and the bloke in the back. That's how we got through it. Because he's a watch kid. Interference. Somebody doing it, you see. We might be a Jerry or something like that doing it. Could be.
Did you always get enough munitions? You know, ammunition.
Oh yes. At the beginning, they were a bit short. You see, you couldn't throw too much about. But America did produce a lot, and our girls were working ammunition factories all over the country. And we matched up. We passed the Jerry. But in the beginning, he was on top, you see, with stuff to blast and kill.
Did you ever meet the Australian troops?
Huh?
Did you ever meet Australian
troops? Oh, yes. We met some Australian troops when they threw the one in and in the Mediterranean, remember? Churchill, well, he was blamed for it anyway.
Gallipoli, was it? Gallipoli?
Gallipoli.
When they came back, Gallipoli. Yes.
They went there, they sent some more ships there, some of our bigger ships.
Yes, I know about the history of it, but I wondered, did you meet the Australians yourself?
Yes. And
what did you think of them?
Oh, there was one fellow. Oh, they're pretty good. Some of the boys I met there, out in France. They came over to France. And he was telling me he had been out in Australia 12 years or something. 12 years, I believe. And he had acquired a spot of land, a good piece of land, and he was growing everything on the land, all kinds of fruits and things like that.
What did you think of them as fighters, the Australians? Were they good troops to be fighting with?
No different to us anyway, I don't believe.
How about the French troops? You know, did you have much to do with them?
Not much, no, not with the French. But they, like us, you see, playing home, like you see, and the war was so close to them, the same as us then. I believe myself that the fighting of the French and the British, well, you couldn't beat them. I mean, doggedly. I don't think so. Because there was a little crowd of Portuguese on the front, you see, pushed in, and I remember one Frenchman again. He was an officer, and he pushed into a battery, and you could know him by smelling him. He was all scent. You could scent it from covered in all different scents. The officers.
I wonder
who was. Who he was, and anyway, he was killed with us.
Well, what did you think of the generals and the staff, I wonder?
So when we started, in Winchester, we started really. And Lewis, he had come up from an ordinary family, Lewis. He was a good footballer, good speed, under even time, of course. Very speedy, and he was playing with Cambridge Blue. He was all right. When he was a major, of course, in Chad, he was all right. Miller was all right, another Englishman. And Pesketh, he was a regular, Lieutenant Colonel Rudkin. I don't know whether he was a bit Irish or something, he was a brigade commander. And yeah, pretty good.
Did you get on quite well with your officers? You know, were your relationships good?
Yes. Oh, pretty good, yes.
What did you think of the top generals? You said you saw Haig.
Oh,
Haig,
well, you're supposed to have made mistakes. I don't know what to say. Only what you'd hear somebody else saying, or in the papers, they didn't think much of him, I believe. So easy to make mistakes, so easy to pass an order to somebody else to, scrub the floor. So easy to start at the top now, what to do. Can you do it better? Or could you do it as good? That's beside the point. I'm the boss. That's how they are. But there's one thing that struck me more than anything, I believe. There could be a gentleman agreement between the top brass, who are supposed to be real enemies to one another. For instance, the Chateaus out in France and Belgium, I noticed this much more than once. The chateau was here, like a building, a bit of a paras, we call it. Mansion. There was like a square of land, green, if you like, around this mansion. You wouldn't find anything like shallows and things like that, where all the other parts would be ruffled and blasted to pieces. And this is where these big blokes would be meeting, you see. Well, would the people who are supposed to be giving orders from us then, you see, giving orders not to disturb their lot over there? It might be. But there's one thing for certain. Jim Griffiths, he was a conscious objector, Jim, but years before the war, when he came up to be a job in the government and all this and that, I believe it was in Ruskin College, he had his degree, and things like that. But he was a good MP, and everybody respected him. But he was saying, you see, when the fighting was at its worst, what they call, and people were expected and were acting like bull terriers towards one another, pulling one another to pieces. That Montague Norman, and he was naming many of them, when the war was at its worst, Montague Norman and these were meeting in a place in Spain or something. There were the big dudes with the big bankers. He was saying that. What was going on behind the scene?
Do you think the Great War had important effects on your life? Were there any sort of long-lasting effects, do you think?
Well, I don't know. It's hard to tell, but
did you change? You did,
after seeing, we are sitting here together now, and say we're half a dozen, or six or seven or eight, and we find after, it happened so quick that only us two, only you and I, are alive here proper, and with mentally sound and all this and that. You see the rest laying around, been killed, isn't it? Well, I don't know what to do. I did dream more than in the beginning. Dreams come to you, it repeats itself. Recurs like a recurring decimal or something. Else. It repeats itself like it. And with the years, they are fading away.
They didn't go away straight.
Because you'd see so much, so many lying about. What you after a scrap like that, you see. When we are walking about and when we see a crowd lying about, and it's a terrible thing, torsos and legs and things like that flying about, you know, you see parts of them about the place, and well, it's true, and you don't want to talk about it and you want to forget it, but it does repeat itself. I mean, it does come back.
When you came back
to
Wales?
Well, there's a job. You'd naturally go straight underground as soon as you came back. There was a job. And at that time, you see, there were Irishmen coming over from Ireland. They'd always have a job working on the banks of some of these colonies. And that's how you'd find there, mostly. And a person coming back from the army, especially a minder, as a rule, his place is ready for him, he'll push in easy.
Well, Mr. Jones, thank you very much indeed for telling me so many of your wartime experiences. Thank you.
Thank you. We are in the church. The chapelman picked up and went to college and went and made a vicar of himself. And what I mean to say is, what did you ask, sir?
Yeah, I'll just...